Welcome into the NHL At The Rink podcast. Dan Rosen here, Sean Rourke out there. The Stanley Cup playoffs are underway. Sean, we had an epic, I would call it, opening to the playoffs. First game Tuesday, five overtimes. I'm still trying to get over it.
You know, I joked when the qualifiers started, I tweeted out one of the first days, I'm like, you know, we had 4 months to get in hockey shape, and I'm not in playoff shape because I can't handle the days as they go along. And then the first game of the first round, we get a five overtime classic, the second longest game in modern history. Unbelievable. And no place to go, nothing to do. You don't have to worry about the crowd. And, you know, just what great theater. I mean, when you think about it, Seth Jones played over 60 minutes. Korpisalo had a record of saves, but beat Kelly Rudy's record by 11, I think it was, when all was said and done. And then the Tampa Bay Lightning, who had been cursed in playing the Columbus Blue Jackets, had lost four straight last year. People were rubbing their faces in it once that matchup was set. And they showed the tenacity and the courage and whatever else you want to say to finally win that game, which I think was huge for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's funny, as that game was going on and overtime was bleeding into the next overtime and into the next overtime, I was thinking to myself, the two different ways this could go for the Tampa Bay Lightning. Win this game, it sets them up, I think, and it gives them that little extra push that they need. Lose it, and I think that they would have been in more of a world of hurt than the Columbus Blue Jackets. We're recording this on Thursday. Those teams are going to play again in 3.5 hours from the time we're recording this, Sean. So we don't know where this is going to go at the time we're recording this, but I just thought it was so important for the Lightning to get that goal, to win that game, because if not, now they got more questions. Can they do this? Could they have the intestinal fortitude to overcome all of those things? Even though we know they probably can, now they've proved it. And I think it's such an important part. This could be such an important part of the playoffs. If the Lightning were to go on a run, they're going to look back at this moment, I think, and say that was the moment where they realized the team that they have now is not like the team that they had last year. I think if this was the team last year, and not to disparage their regular season last year, but if this was the team they had last year, I don't know that they win that game. I don't know that they can carry through that game because they just didn't have that type of battle level, in my opinion. They had it. They kept with it. They won the game. I think it could be really big for them. We'll see where it goes from here, but I think it could be huge for them.
Yeah, look, we're going to talk about the mental aspect and the physical aspect, especially for the goalies, with Kevin Woodley when we have him on a little later, the managing partner of In Goal Magazine. He's going to deal on so much goalie stuff. Henrik Lundqvist's future, Tristan Jarry and Matt Murray in Pittsburgh, Jacob Markstrom, a lot on Korpisalo. So, and some save selection nuggets that have been a big part of the playoffs so far. But look, I think the biggest thing Tampa Bay takes out of that game is they went more than five periods without giving up a goal. That defensive identity that they had been looking for ever since I went with them to Sweden at the start of the year, and they had some trouble finding it against Buffalo, and had trouble before that. You know, it seems like they found that, and a huge part of that was getting Victor Hedman back after seeing him go down in that last round robin game with his ankle and smashing his stick against the wall. He's one of the most mild-mannered people I've ever met, so to see him, you know, like a crazed Viking, suggested that it was a high ankle sprain and it was going to be a long time. And he went out and he played some really hard minutes and played well. So I'm sure John Cooper had a bit of an exhale when it was all over.
No question about it. And I think back to last year again with Victor Hedman, he was hurt throughout that four game set against Columbus, didn't play games 3 and 4 in that series either. That was a huge loss. That was significant. That was a big reason why I think the Lightning struggled in that series the way they did. There were so many other reasons, but he is such an important part. Victor Hedman to the Lightning is what Seth Jones is to the Blue Jackets. I mean, what was amazing to me, Sean, was looking at Seth Jones in the post-game press conference on Zoom. The man looked like he didn't even play, right? I mean, it was incredible. The guy played 65 minutes, and he's just kind of sitting there, laid back in the chair, and it's fine and all that. The shape that these guys are in after being off for 4 months, to me, it's just incredible what they're able to do with their bodies.
And think about the guys that he was matched up against. who can skate like crazy, Kucherov, all those guys. I mean, the Palat, they just fly, right? So it's not like even 10 years ago. Look, Nick Lidstrom was a great defenseman, and he got to coast a lot, right? He could skate. He could move the puck. And I'm not saying that he couldn't. One of the greatest skaters I've ever seen. But the way the game was played, there was a lot more downtime when you didn't have the puck and everything else. And you know, the game's gotten faster every year since. So to play that many minutes under that kind of stress, you know, pretty much every second shift was ridiculous. But the thing I found amazing in that five overtime game, and then the next day, so the Bruins and the Hurricanes get delayed and then postponed, like it's some sort of youth tournament, and then the next day they have to play at 11 in the morning. They play overtime, and in both of those games the stakes are unbelievable, the physical and mental stress are unbelievable. There's dudes lining up for faceoffs laughing as they're doing this, just, you know, smiling after a goal, he makes a big save, whatever it is. Like, they're clearly having fun playing hockey, which they would at any time. But I also think, you know, after everything that we've been through and to get to this point, this deep in the bubble, and realize that playoff hockey is the same as it would have been in June, I think the players really appreciate that and really are embracing this opportunity to win a cup that they didn't know that they would have in April and May.
Yeah, and it looks the same. I mean, like, honestly, I'm watching these games and I'm like, this is playoff hockey. This looks exactly like what we would expect playoff hockey. And I got to give the league a lot of credit for this. It even sounds a little bit like it too. I know it's a made for TV thing and they're pumping a little sound noise, but I've gotten to the point where I'm watching so many games now that I don't even realize that there's no fans in the stands as I watch the games. I'm watching what's going on the ice and the intensity that these guys have. It's remarkable. I will say, I got to give a ton of credit to the Hurricanes and Bruins. That could not have been an easy thing. I mean, that's unique, right? That's that to be in the building and waiting, just waiting to see if you're going to play. I kind of thought of it as like a baseball team in a rain delay, right? You know, like you're getting yourself ready to go. If you're a starting pitcher, especially, or, you know, in this instance, a goaltender, you have your routines, right? You're doing the things that you normally do. You're waiting. This game goes to the second overtime, the third overtime, the fourth overtime, the fifth overtime, and eventually you're going home because you're not playing. You got to reset to play at 11 a.m. Eastern the next day. That's a very challenging thing to do for players who have their own routines. Even if your normal routine is thrown out of whack because you're in the bubble, you've established by this point a new routine because you've been there long enough and played enough games, and now that gets broken up. And for those teams, the Bruins and the Hurricanes, to come out and play the way they did and then also go to double overtime, that's not an easy thing to do what they did. I don't think people realize how difficult that can be, and they were able to do it and make it look pretty easy too.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing it reminds me of is college hockey, right? Either the beanpot or a regional or a championship where they play under those same rules. You play overtime until somebody wins. And they've had some long games, like especially in the semifinals or the regionals in the NCAA where games have gone 3-4 overtimes and the next team's waiting to play. And they actually play afterwards, which I think might have even been harder because you're just so – for so long you're trying to stay sharp. At least, you know, the Bruins and the Hurricanes got to shut it down, and then they didn't have to think about it anymore. They basically woke up and played when they would normally morning skate. So, and it was a great game. I mean, just a fantastic game to watch. And, you know, is in Toronto, it hasn't really happened in Edmonton yet, but in Toronto, are we going to have another overtime game today? Is that going to be like the overtime city? We're going to have multiple overtimes every day in Toronto and throw the schedule completely out of whack and make Dean Matsusuke's life in the NHL head in Toronto just have a horrible existence?
Well, who knows? Maybe we will. But look, can we put something to bed real fast here? Please, let's play overtime until it ends. Let's never change this rule in the playoffs. I know there was some thing going on and, you know, social media. I believe Mike Milbury mentioned it on the broadcast on NBC. They should end it. They should go to 3-on-3, end it that way. No. Let's continue to play this until we're in that game. That Lightning Blue Jackets game doesn't become the epic, you know, all-timer that it is already without the rules that are currently in place. We need to continue this. It's just silly to even think about changing it. These guys can handle it. They love it. Fans love it. Let's not mess with the good thing.
No, of course not. Look, I think there's special circumstances this year. I think, you know, with two games in a building and, you know, if that early game goes into overtime, it throws everything into chaos, you know, like it did for the Bruins and the Hurricanes. I think maybe that's where some of this comes from. But in a normal playoff season, it doesn't matter. It only affects those two teams and maybe your TV viewing if you want to watch the late game and it gets bumped from whatever channel you're going to watch it on nationally to another channel. But otherwise, there's no impact at all on SEP on the players. And that's part of the lure of winning the Stanley Cup, right? Like, think about it. If one of these teams wins the Stanley Cup, the best game that they'll remember is the game they won the Stanley Cup in. The second game will be this game, no matter how many games they play, whether it's, you know, 34 or whether it's, you know, 19.
They'll never forget this game for the rest of their lives. I mean, never.
And it'll never be forgotten in history, and that's the only way it can happen. If it had gone to a shootout, if it had gone to 3-on-3 and somebody scored 2 minutes in, nobody would remember it. But everybody's going to remember this because people love sacrifice. They love people being pushed to their limits. You watch that game to watch what people could accomplish. And look, I'm not going to lie. That fifth overtime, that looked like Sunday rec league hockey at some points. Guys were tired. Guys were struggling. Like when that puck went in the corner and the D had to go from in front of his net to go get the puck in the corner, it was ugly, man. It was like the battleships were going in and trying to get into port, but it was equal. And somebody was going to have a burst and somebody was going to have that trick, that quick trigger release. And somebody was going to do something special, and everybody was equal. It wasn't like there were 19 guys that were struggling and one guy gets to come on at the end. It was everybody was playing under the same circumstances. And you know, there ended up being no Peter Klima because everybody played, and so there wasn't anybody fresh coming on in overtime after sitting since the second period like he did for the Edmonton Oilers back in the day. But I didn't care that the game was slower. It was slower for everybody, and it was the drama was – I was on the edge of the seat of my couch just losing my mind with every shot. Me and my son were watching, and everything was oohing and on. And it reminded me after a lot of hard work why we do this and why we love it so much.
Yeah, and it's a made-for-TV event right now, and that was perfect drama on TV. Couple other things before we get to Kevin Woodley, who is also a correspondent with us for NHL.com, writes an Unmasked column. He's got a good one coming Friday. I wanted to get to a game I covered late last night here on the East Coast, the Canucks, and we'll talk a little bit about the Canucks with Kevin Woodley since he covers them, but really the defending Stanley Cup champion, St. Louis Blues, you know, you think about it, 2-2 game going in the third period, you got the Blues with all that experience, you think to yourselves, okay, this is where the Blues are going to just, you know, they're going to sit on them, right? They're going to score, they're going to sit on them, they're going to lock it down, they're going to go ahead because that's what they do and that's what they did so well. Well, it was the Canucks who came out and scored 3 goals in the third period. Vancouver, I've been high on Vancouver. I picked Vancouver to win this series. They really showed me something in that game last night. Their ability to, you know, just, you know, handle the Blues push and come back from it. I think St. Louis can be in a world of trouble here against the Canucks.
I don't believe that. After watching the Stanley Cup final last year and how many times they were written off in that 7-game series, every time they lost, oh, well, the Bruins, they got the championship pedigree. Jordan Binnington's finally cracking under the pressure. You know, Craig Berube's never coached in a big game in his life. Hey, you could go down the line, and every time they came back and they won. And then game 7 in Boston, everything was on the table for the veteran Bruin team that had been through so many championships. And what chance did St. Louis have? And they ran them off the ice. So I think it's a fool's errand to say after one game that St. Louis could be in trouble, especially because St. Louis hasn't played a serious game until last night, right? The round robins, look, they were important for seeding. Philadelphia did a nice job in the East to get that one seed, and now they play, because of the upset, they play arguably the worst team in the East. The same thing in the West with Chicago advancing. But St. Louis had nothing to play for. They had nothing to be ready for. And now they have to get ready. So it's kind of like in a regular playoffs when you win in 4 games and you have a week and a half to sit around like Carolina did last year before they played Boston. Mm-hmm. And the team you're playing just came off an emotional 7 games and only had a day to recover and are in game shape. The Vancouver Canucks were in game shape. The St. Louis Blues, I don't know if they were in playoff game shape. Let's see what happens in game 2.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to say that the Blues can't win this series. That would be ridiculous to me. I just think that the Canucks are going to cause them a lot of trouble in this series. And if the Blues are going to win it, it's going to be a challenging series for them to win. Whereas I think a lot of people probably looking at the series going into it were saying, all right, the Blues can get past the Canucks. The Canucks have 10 guys going into this one who never played in a playoff series before they played the Wild. So those are some things to look. I liked what I saw from Vancouver. I liked their speed. I love Quinn Hughes on the power play. Power play went 3-for-6. There was a lot to like there from the Canucks is my point. But I have another one I want to bring up to you again before we get to Kevin. What about the team that won the Stanley Cup the year before St. Louis, Washington Capitals? Alex Ovechkin has played 4 games. He has no points. Nicholas Backstrom got banged up. The Islanders have looked very good in this return to play. It was almost as if the pause has really done them good. They've reset their entire game. Do you think the Capitals are in trouble?
I think the Capitals are in trouble if Nick Backstrom's in trouble and isn't coming back anytime soon. He missed the end of that game after taking the hit from Lee, and there's been no prognosis given. Eller comes back today. John Carlson, who missed all of the round robins, looked good for having missed that much time. Again, I think a lot of these round robin teams, except for Philadelphia, who took it really seriously, are paying, and Colorado took it really seriously in Vegas, and they've come out of the chute like gangbusters. But Boston seemed to be trying to find their game and avoid injuries. Washington, the same thing. So those teams, I think, are still getting up to speed. To me, the Capitals can score goals, and that's the game breaker here, right? In game one, it was the Islanders who scored goals. They scored 4 straight, and they won it. And look, I thought the Capitals quit in that game, and some of their players said that they thought they quit, and that's a damning assessment. But there's a lot of pedigree there, and I think, to me, it's one of the most interesting series because the Capitals are going to have to break down the Islanders' defense, and they showed early on that they can. And that was the one series out of all of them that opened with hostility, malice.
Oh yeah, it did.
It just started from the first puck, and it was a playoff game from go. So that's going to be a great series to watch.
Yeah, no question about it. And you brought up, before we get to Kevin, we'll get to Kevin in a second here, you brought up Colorado and Vegas. They look like gangbusters right now, and they look like they're on a collision course to meet in what could be an epic series, right?
Yeah, and we are going to get to Kevin right now, and the one thing I regret that we didn't ask him about was, to me, one of the biggest shocks was Robin Lehner starting in place of Marc-Andre Fleury for Vegas. Had some mishaps with his skates. I couldn't believe his skates are 4 years old. Peter DeBoer, after the game, almost lost his mind when he found out, and he's got the clip-in skates, and they fell out twice, and he was flopping all around the ice and whatever else. But to me, that was a shock that Lehner played in that game. I thought they would show some loyalty to Marc-Andre Fleury. I don't know that there's a huge difference between the two of them. I guess Peter has no loyalty to anybody because he didn't go on that run with them 2 years ago. So, but with back-to-back games and everything else, there's a few teams. Carolina's another one where I think we might see goalie rotations that we didn't see in past playoffs, where it's really, unless it's been performance or injury related, you've gone with one goalie. But I only know a little bit about goaltending. Kevin knows everything. Kevin Woodley knows everything about goaltending. He writes Unmasked for us that appears every Friday. He has his own goalie magazine called In Goal Magazine that he does. He's a consultant with Team Canada. The man knows his goaltending, so if we want to know goaltending, we should talk to him.
And let's do that right now. Let's get to that interview that we did with Kevin Woodley. If you want to learn something about goaltending, listen to this interview. Kevin, thanks so much for jumping on with us. By the way, obviously the audience can't see it, but we can because we're on Zoom. You're making Sean and I look like we're recording in a garage somewhere with your boom mic and your spit guards and everything. And then the perfect background with the Carey Price jersey too there from Team Canada. This is quite a setup you got there.
Yeah, a little bit of a goalie geek office for sure. I mean, if I could pan the computer around, we've got memorabilia from just mostly some of the guys that I've had the opportunity to work with, right? And the Olympic jerseys in the back. You know, the funny story there is we actually had a live webinar with Carey Price during the NHL pause. And before the live webinar, the Luongo Olympic jersey and the Price signed Olympic jersey were reversed. And somebody's like, no, dude, you got to have the Price one prominently. And the other thing we did during the pause is we ran a bunch of symposiums for Hockey Canada, who I do some consulting work with. And so obviously no one can see it, but if I move here and move the boom mic, it's a Henrik Lundqvist. So it's the last three NHL Olympic winning goalies signed personalized jerseys behind me. But when I was doing the Hockey Canada stuff, I had to make sure everything was positioned so that nobody could see the Henrik Lundqvist jersey. So there's a funny backdrop for you.
But now you've given away all the secrets for all the Hockey Canada people that listen to At the Rink. And Carey Price, who listens every week.
They don't pay me enough in those tiny little small minuscule consulting roles and things I do with them to take down the jersey of the king. I'm sorry.
Well, let's talk a little goaltending, because the first thing I wanted to ask you about, because you would have, you know, you talk to all these guys and know what they go through. A five overtime game, right, in which we had in the first day of the playoffs, we had it on Tuesday. How do goalies handle that in between periods? What are they doing? What are they putting in their bodies to keep going? Because we hear skaters get a rest on a bench. The goaltender has to stand out there the whole time.
Yeah, no, goalies can lose a ton of fluids in a game, right? And we've written stories about it at NHL.com over the years. What was the one this year? Sean, pickle juice was one of the things that they were using to try and help hydrate. So it's not just players. There have been goalies over the years that have lost as much as 15 pounds in a regular NHL game. And these were skinny guys to begin with. I remember Dan Ellis sharing those numbers, and my jaw just dropped. So I think part of being a goalie, Jaguar obviously has talked a lot about during his career about the work he did with the Gatorade Institute to sort of try and learn to manage your fluid intake. And I think that all just gets amplified when you get into one of those marathon sessions. Now, I'll be honest, I didn't drop in on any of the Zooms following that or with Columbus or Tampa Bay in the time since. But obviously I have experience with not quite five, but four overtime games here in Vancouver. I remember the lead, Sean, for NHL.com. Roberto Luongo waited his whole career to get into his first playoff game, figured he'd get two out of the way, right? Like, they played four OT in his first playoff game. There was IVs going on like crazy post-game of that. Like, you just can't get enough fluids into you to manage the loss. So in some cases in the past, you've seen goalies actually take IVs in between periods because that's the only way they can get those fluid back. Interestingly enough, and I'm really curious to see where this goes, because obviously Merzlikins wasn't on the bench as a healthy backup option that day, and their back-to-backs in this first round aren't until game 6 and 7. But if Merzlikins is healthy, do you consider, just from a rest standpoint, as good as Korpisalo has been? Because the reality is, as soon as that game started going like that, I texted Roberto Luongo right away, and I'm like, what's the recovery on this? And Lou said for him it was 3 to 4 days. Didn't stop him from playing, but 3 to 4 days to fully recover physically and feel like himself after going four overtime. So I imagine those goaltenders are probably still struggling a couple days later. It'll be interesting to see how Columbus, if Merzlikins especially is available, manage this because of that such a unique circumstance.
Well, fortunately, it's both goalies. I remember the first year I covered the NHL, I had a four overtime game I covered. It was Hasek and Brodeur in the old odd, which was 1,000 degrees, and four overtime, 70 shots. Hasek faced, Brodeur faced a little less. But I remember walking in the Devil's room, and Marty was so young, and he was virtually passed out on the trainer's table, just couldn't get up. And that was a game 6, and they had to play a game 7 2 days later. And I was like, there's no way the Devils win this now. Like, they're done. And Marty came out. I think he gave up one goal, and they went on that long run to the Eastern Conference final. So you never know what's going to happen. But I just, when you look at Korpisalo, to me, the most amazing thing is the way that he came back after being replaced by Merzlikins, being pulled, and then came back and had that game 5 shutout, and then did what he did against Tampa Bay in game 1. He's really impressed me since he's gotten that job.
Yeah, no, and I was going to say, beware the wounded beast when it comes to goaltender. Like, I mean, it's all playoffs, right? But goalies especially, how many times have we seen, like, you know, not 100% or fighting something or a flu or whatever, and they go out and have the game of their lives. So I certainly wouldn't discount Korpisalo after having to play so much, or Vasilevsky. Korpi is a guy who, it's funny, because I'm not sure, I'm only say this because I actually have it on the record somewhere, but when Bob left for Florida, I wasn't stressed. And that's because of Korpisalo and Merzlikins and Daniil Tarasov. Like, the depth chart in Columbus in terms of prospects that they built over the past 5 years is unrivaled from a goaltending standpoint in the NHL. And Korpisalo was one of those guys that when you talk to coaches, I mean, obviously I watch games, but really I rely on guys who are true experts to sort of fill me in and what are they seeing. And when you talk to goalie coaches around the league about him, even while Bob was winning two Vezinas, they all felt like he had this in him. They were all very big on him. As a matter of fact, I caught crap on Canucks Twitter because Thatcher Demko's NHL debut a couple of years ago was opposite Jonas Korpisalo on the other end. And I just made the mistake, and we know Canucks Twitter can be a little aggressive at times, of pointing out that I wonder how many people realize the higher touted goalie prospect is not the one in Canucks colors tonight. And it was nothing against Thatcher Demko, who I'm a massive fan of and think has big things in his future. It's just that I had heard all these things about Korpisalo. And of course, Korpisalo had a terrible game that night, and I ate a whole bunch of crow online. But this, now that he's been able to get the rhythm and the timing and the familiarity of playing on a regular basis and the comfort level that comes with not knowing you're going to get yanked, you know, if you have one bad game, or if you have one bad game, Bob's going to start for two straight weeks and you're going to gather rust. Like this has always been there for him. And so I do think, too, some of those experiences in dealing with the mental pressure of not playing very often probably helped him, Sean, in terms of coming back after losing the job and watching Merzlikins play. Like, and you've talked, like, there's a Finnish thing here, and you've been on, you know, you've talked to Jonas over the years. Like, much like Tuukka, there's very much a water off duck's back type of mentality here. I don't think a whole lot is going to phase Jonas Korpisalo. And frankly, when John Tortorella is your head coach, it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, no question about it. What about Manny Legacy, though, with that team? Because you talk to any goalie within that system and they just rave about Manny and what he's able to do. You talk to John Tortorella and he raves about Manny, because Torts will be the first to tell you he doesn't know a thing about goaltending. But Manny obviously does, and he has full faith in him.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Manny went into a tough spot there, because the guy he replaced in Ian Clark, who can be a very abrasive personality, very strong personality. Obviously, he came back to Vancouver here, and I know him well, so there's a bias there. Ian was actually the guy who introduced me to goaltending in the early 2000s. It's not like I played growing up. I sort of came to it in my mid-30s, basically by editing a magazine for him. So, you know, I have biases towards Ian Clark, but, you know, he is a guy who, from a technical standpoint, is, like, he's up there in the sort of Mitch Korn, Francois, like, he has written more and done more in terms of developing the position than a lot of guys. But he's also a very strong personality. So following that in Columbus couldn't have been easier. What Manny seems to have really done is not just take care of the technical side with these guys, but build the relationship side with them. When you listen to Elvis talk, when you listen to Jonas talk about, like, it's a relationship. There's a trust factor there both ways. And without discounting the technical side, that matters too, right? Like, you see a guy like Dusty Emu, who, when he was in a development role with the Los Angeles Kings, and he actually lives just down the street, so we talk a fair bit. He's not going to point to, like, Torts says X's and O's. It's more about the mental game. Guys like Dusty and Manny, the X's and O's are still there. The technical efficiencies, the biomechanics, all these things that I like to geek out over goaltending. But if you can't manage and build a relationship with a person and find a way to make them feel good about themselves and about their game, it's probably all for naught. And Manny's done a fantastic job of doing both in a tough spot, replacing a guy who, like I said, on that list of goalie coaches, and this is an argument for another day, who I think should be in the Hall of Fame at some point. Like, it's Francois Allaire, Benoit Allaire, Mitch Korn, and Ian Clark isn't far down that list because of the technical things he has brought to the game that, you know, reinvented the position in a lot of ways.
Look, I could talk all day about the Columbus goalies. I think they're fascinating. We haven't even talked about Elvis, but we got to move on. You know a lot about Carey Price. People were talking about Carey Price coming into this and, you know, oh my God, he's going to be the one guy that if Montreal's going to win, he's going to be the guy, but can he do it anymore? He did it. It wasn't just him. Look, Montreal played a great series, kind of caught a Penguins team that may have been looking ahead a little bit, wasn't motivated enough, but Carey worked his magic and it looked great in the first game of the first round here. When you look at him, do you see a goalie now who is the same goalie that you know, was arguably the MVP of the Canadiens during their longer runs in the last few years.
Well, see, so there was a lot of pushback, I think, at least on social media and sometimes from the analytics community a little bit, on the concept of Carey could steal a series. A lot of people wanted to point to the fact that he hasn't been Carey, the Carey Price we know since, you know, what it was, 2014-15 when he won the Hart Trophy and the Vezina, and that's 5 years ago. But the truth is, when you look at some of the adjusted numbers, like this was a down year for Carey. Last season, from a goals save metric, on some of the proprietary stuff I have access to, the only guy in the entire NHL who saved his team more goals based on shot quality was Andrei Vasilevskiy. Carey Price should have been in the Vezina conversation if you use those numbers last season. So first off, he is not like 5 years removed from being Carey Price. That said, this is the benefit of a rested Carey Price in the playoffs at a time. I think it caught a lot of people off guard his first media session sort of post-NHL pause due to coronavirus, he said, I haven't seen a puck in 4 months, and people worried. But that's Carey's MO. That's his routine. He puts the pads away, he puts the skates away all summer until August 1st. So I think guys like that, Braden Holtby's in that group, that don't rely on skating all summer, were more comfortable coming back. So you've got a rested Price coming back. He's coming back to a situation that feels perfectly natural for him. It's not like he's trying to manufacture confidence after 4 months off. He's used to taking 4 months off. But in terms of seeing the same Carey Price, this is where it's interesting. I see a bit of a different Carey Price. And I've had this conversation with a couple different goalie people around the league who are watching as members of teams that aren't in. Carey's more aggressive right now, especially was in that Pittsburgh series. He's aggressive but in control, and that's always what's defined his game. The ability to beat plays, get to spots, not just get there, but get there square, get there set, get there with a reactive mindset. He's not chasing, and he's doing it all playing further out and more aggressively than he has in the past. You watch his post play, and we're going to have a lot of talk about post play in these playoffs, but like he's loading up VH outside his posts as a reactive position at a time when most in the league are either using VH or reverse VH on the post as a passive position. When some of those segments I saw, and there were some beautiful jobs of sort of overhead shots on social media against the Penguins power play, and they are moving it around like tic-tac-toe, like it's August Shinny, and Carey is, you know, getting to every spot and set, and even when he's on his knees, getting rotation, set, square, there, making them make perfect shots to beat him. And I think eventually that gets into your head. You sit off the crossbar in the elimination game. You got to make a perfect shot to beat him. But he's doing it from a more aggressive position. There's more movement. There's more depth aggression in his game than there typically is. And I thought that was a fascinating adjustment. And it's working so far. So same Carey, but not quite the same. There's a difference in his game right now that I'm not sure we've seen this consistently over the past couple of years, and maybe that's just having the energy levels to play like this after all this time off.
And then he just reaches out his stick blade and knocks a puck out of the air that nobody should be stopping, which was incredible.
Hey, there's right? a rule I mean, of thumb. Like, that's the thing, though. Everybody goes, just lucky, right? Rule of thumb, and this goes back to Cam Ward 2006, the first time I heard it in that playoffs. In desperation, get something, whatever you can. You can go back and rewind it on his Conn Smythe run. He did it a lot. Get something to the middle of the net. Because if a guy's got a wide open net and an empty net as a shooter, I don't care how skilled you are, the mindset is he's going to toss it right into the middle of the net. And I guarantee if you go back and look at that replay, that puck is headed for right in the middle of a 4x6, and that's where Carey sticks something. So they're like, absolute pure desperation, never give up. But we actually have a technical rule for that, and it paid off. So people are like, yeah, sure. But seriously, get something to the middle of the net. That's rule number one when you're trapped.
Look, I'm a total goalie geek like you, and we can't spend a ton of time on it, but I do want to circle back. You talked about VH and reverse VH, which are save selections and, you know, have to do with post play a little bit. The biggest controversy of the qualifier round, and it's leaked a little bit into the first round, is the reverse VH quote unquote fails. The goal in the Pittsburgh series where Murray gave up the short side to Petrie, and there's been numerous other ones like that. And you know, all the armchair goalies are now out and saying, oh, what a dumb save selection, why do they do that, just stand up against the post. Tell us why everybody's wrong.
Okay, I'm not sure everybody's wrong in terms of sometimes it's the wrong save selection for those situations, and we have seen some goals where it's like, Okay, the Matt Murray one, you could argue, as much as I understood it in some ways, you can't, I mean, you got to call a spade, right? Like, as much as I like to play my goalie union card and I don't want them to take it away, these things happen. And you could argue whether that was the right save selection. It exposed a hole that Jeff Petrie found. Small hole. You might argue it's that puck still goes in if he squares up and butterflies on him and drops early. So it's so just like you can execute a butterfly prematurely and become more of a blocker than a reactive goalie, you can do it with reverse VH. Where the criticism bugs me and bugs goalie coaches and bugs the goalies themselves is when it gets into not criticizing the execution or the save selection, but it almost feels like, and I promise, Sean, this column is almost done. It'll be on your desk when we stop recording here. But instead of criticizing the goalie for executing poorly or choosing it at the wrong time, they just rip into this RVH fail. And I would argue it's more of a failed RVH. In other words, and we saw it in game one of that Columbus series, right? Like that puck, that second goal against Vasilevskiy, he's in the reverse VH as it sails over his shoulder. And everyone goes, oh, RVH fail. And I'm like, why are you in RVH when the puck's on the half wall at the hash marks? This is a sharp angle behind the net save selection. Last time I checked, the hash marks on the wall aren't sharp angle saves. Like, that's not a sharp angle, and it sure as heck isn't behind the net. Similar on Murray, he's close. The other example, too, is people don't recognize when they miss, when they just execute it poorly. Jacob Markstrom didn't give up a goal from a dead angle in using RVH all season. And it's one of his biggest improvements, not just in terms of, it's not just the save to make the save, seal the post. It's the movement in and out of the post that a well-executed RVH allows. And Markstrom, I would argue again, his biggest improvement as a goalie over the past couple of years. Roberto Luongo said the same thing last 5 years of his career. Nothing changed his game more than the RVH. Everyone liked to say RVH fail every time it went over my shoulder, but they missed the 10 to 15 saves that allowed me to make easily that I couldn't before. So that criticism bugs us a little bit in the goalie world, or at least some. Jacob Markstrom in that game failed to execute on all three goals. So all season, no goals. He gives up three in one game. All because of RVH. The Eric Staal goal is that spot we just talked about. It's a sharp angle. It is above the goal line, but you could argue it's a good one for RVH. Goes right over that spot on the shoulder. Well, two things. One, I'm not sure he saw the release. And two, what Markstrom does as well as anyone is he activates the back leg so that he can drive that shoulder because he's 6'6". On a 6-foot goalie, I'd say no. But on Markstrom, we watch him all year. He drives that shoulder right up to the crossbar and seals it. Heck, he made a save like that last night, but he didn't do it in that instance. The first goal actually was a scramble that Matt Zuccarello banked off the bottom of his pad. Well, the only reason that gap between the post and the bottom of Markstrom's pad exists is because when he went into the post in an RVH stance, he missed. Normally, he would have the toe box of the pad, the bottom of the pad sealed against the post, and his skate slightly inside the post. So that gap doesn't exist. But again, failed execution of RVH leads to a bad goal. And then the third one, drive down the wing, sharp angle goal. Again, another bad goal. Two things happen. One, he misses. You can freeze frame it. You can watch his blocker isn't where he wants it to be. Again, misses his execution. And as the shot's coming, he's pulling it back to where he wants it to seal it. That's the first mistake. Puck goes in between the arm and the blocker. Second mistake is you still have to react in it. And you could see in that one, and I would argue you could see it in the Freddie Anderson goal. Second goal of the elimination game against Columbus is another quote-unquote RVH fail. In both cases, those guys appeared to be more concerned about that little hole over the shoulder that we've all been talking about, and they lifted up rather than reacting to the shot. And as soon as you lift up in a passive mode and you're not watching the puck, like, there is constant give and take in this position. Lift up to take away the hole, you're going to open up a hole somewhere else. And fate have it, the puck almost always finds those holes. It's just the way it goes.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to go back to, you mentioned something about Vasilevskiy, like, it wasn't a bad angle shot. Why are you going into the RVH? Are goaltenders now doing that? Is it, I remember, you know, the talk of the butterfly, oh, he would just go down, right? He would just always go down, even if it wasn't necessary. That would be the reaction. Is it becoming a reaction to just do that move, to go into that technique, even if they don't have to? And is that something that you're starting to see too?
Well, I think what I'm seeing is there are times where you can get burned in it where it's still the right play to be in it. Because what reverse VH does, And again, this is where the saves that you don't make or that nobody talks about that get made because of it come into play. Korpisalo made one, I think one of his best saves in game one against the Maple Leafs was actually a puck that hit his right pad on a low high pass, quick shot in RVH. And if he's not in that position, that pad isn't there. So what goalies and goalie coaches like about the position is, unlike past post-integration techniques, including just stand up on the post, my favorite. We can go back to the 80s and 90s and watch them bank pucks in off their skates all day, and you tell me how that works. Pad's not there in another save selection, and he makes a save because of it. We've seen a couple. Korpisalo made one, the amazing glove save. Again, people are players in opposition are trying to funnel pucks to the net from dead angles, from behind the net. And reverse VH allows you to sort of have that coverage in the net more than past, past options. And so we see saves like that made. But yes, guys sometimes linger in it too long, like I would argue Vasilevsky maybe did there, and that hole exists when maybe it shouldn't. I would probably argue he didn't see that shot anyway. So even if he squares up to it and he's looking around a screen and he doesn't see it and he drops in the butterfly outside the post, or what we call overlap, probably still a hole, and that puck was shot so well it might still find it. So listen, the criticism is valid at times. Are guys overusing it? Yeah, Corey Schneider got back to me and for the column this week, and I'm just adding those quotes right now because, you know, he agreed the same thing. He didn't want to call out anyone specifically and use any examples, but he felt like it had become a little too passive of a selection. And as much as it doesn't have to be, as a matter of fact, it became popular in part because it was more reactive than the old way of doing it, VH. It allowed you to keep your hands active and more mobility. There are times when goalies go into it too passively and get burned. It's like anything, like you said, Dan, the butterfly, right? Like, execute it poorly and it doesn't work. Are we throwing the butterfly out? Probably not. It's the baby in the bathwater. Reverse VH works. It's just not everyone uses it at the right time or uses it properly every time.
So I'm going to tap into your goalie union card now, make you take your crystal ball out and use your all the insider information you have, and let's talk about a couple of goalie situations going forward. What's next for Hank?
Well, that one I wish I knew. That's a tough one just because you guys would know better than me what he's meant to that franchise in the city of New York, right? Like, I'm a big fan. We talked about the jersey on the back. Like, Hank is a guy who early in his career was very good to us at Ingle and good to me, like would return email, still does even after he became a superstar, with these goalie geek questions. I think you saw in the first half of last season, I know the raw numbers weren't there, but the adjusted numbers put him, before they went to a goalie rotation and basically threw everything he'd ever known out the window in early January, he was actually hanging in there adjusted numbers wise at a top six, top seven level. So the concept that I heard a lot by the time we hit April and March and trade deadline and all that stuff, or I guess March trade deadline, was that Hank was done and he's turned 38 and he's finished. I don't think that's true. And maybe I'm biased because of that relationship, because I like goalies that leave no stone unturned, and he's one of those guys. He didn't rest on his laurels in a Hall of Fame career. He went back to Sweden and tried to find ways to get better. And I thought he was pretty good in game one. Game two, obviously he wasn't as good. At the end of the day, like, I get it for the Rangers. Like, Igor Shesterkin, again, when we talk about adjusted numbers, as good as Hank was when you weighted them, Shesterkin was the best in the NHL over his 12-game sample size. Like, the best. It's not like this kid just came in and was good. He was dominant. And his puck handling changes things for them in their defensive zone. You can't ignore that. It's never been a strength of Henrik. So all those factors, Shesterkin's the future. I get it. I just don't know what happens with Hank. And what I would say, having looked at the numbers critically and looked at his game, I'm not trying to pretend it's perfect, but I don't think it's fallen off the cliff some people seem to believe. And as much as you're not going to be able to run him out there 60 games, like, in a time when you need two guys and 1A, 1B, can't help but think he would help somebody. And at the same time, can you picture him in another uniform? And logistically, who can fit him cap-wise, right? Like, there's a lot of questions I don't have the answer to, but I'm pretty confident in saying I really don't think he's done. As long as he wants to play and has the passion to go back to Sweden like he did during the pause and put the work in, the numbers back it up. When it was a two-goalie rotation, it was him and Georgiev. Like, he was still Henrik Lundqvist. Maybe not quite to the Hall of, because you set the bar so high, but he can still play. I really believe that.
I just don't see him going somewhere else to be a backup. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think that's in his DNA to go and play second fiddle somewhere else and know that he's going to go play second fiddle somewhere else.
I'd certainly see him more as the 1A in a 1A, 1B situation than a 1B. And like you said, we've seen this with Pekka Rinne, right? And Pekka's talked about it openly, and we predicted it. As soon as that pendulum switched over to UC Saros, like, Pekka's a guy who actually changed how he played and started. I mean, he scored an empty net goal this year because he's hyper-aggressive getting out to stop every rim. And the reason he got hyper-aggressive to stop every rim was to stay engaged in games where he didn't get a lot of shots. Everything about that screams, this guy's going to struggle finding his game and rhythm in a backup role where he's not in there every night. You might make the same case for Henrik Lundqvist. As soon as the dynamic changed, and that was a drastic change, like three goalies. But as soon as the dynamic changed, it's fair to question whether he can fit into a different role. But 45, 50 games, you know, the right travel situation. Again, everything he's done is with the Rangers. So, like, you know, the dynamics of where you live, your life, your routines, defensive systems, his relationship with Benoit Allaire. Whether he can duplicate the success without all those elements somewhere else, I'm really not sure. I don't think anyone knows. But based on what I saw this year, saying he's done to me seems premature. As much as I agree with you, Dan, can't see him anywhere else. He's the last iconic goalie. Like, those pads, like, at a time when we used to look at goalies and geek out on the gear and, like, oh, that's so cool. And that's you know, Cujo in the mask, and that was them, iconic. Like, gear, mask, like, there aren't many like Henrik Lundqvist anymore. And seeing it somewhere else with, you know, like Marty in St. Louis, it would be weird.
Last one for me, and probably a tough one. There's going to be changes in Pittsburgh. Jim Rutherford said yesterday that he's likely not going to be able to keep both his goalies in Matt Murray and Tristan Jarry. If you're helping to make that decision with Sullivan, what do you say?
That's a really tough one. I don't have any answers there. We saw the numbers during the regular season. It wasn't a great year for Matt Murray, but a lot of Tristan Jarry's success was early in the season, right? Like, he fell off too as the season went on. And so to say that, despite obvious signs that Tristan Jarry can be a really good goaltender and he's proven it for stretches, man, you haven't done it till you've done it as a number one, right? Like, it's a step. And so to be confident he can take it, you know, I think there are enough signs there that you should be. And the other thing to remember is this is an easier decision because of Casey DeSmith behind them. So that sort of takes some of the burden off, because you know you got another guy that's showing he can play in the National Hockey League. I don't have a right answer here. Matt Murray won two Stanley Cups. There's obviously something there. There were also things in his game while he was winning two Stanley Cups that, you know, that frankly we pointed out in terms of technical and elements. I like that Matt Murray's actually sought out changes even during the pause. He's got a new off-ice trainer, Adam Francilia, who, you know, again, I'm biased. I have the privilege of working with him up in Kelowna in the summers. But this is the guy that oversaw the physical transformation that took Connor Hellebuck to Vezina Trophy finalist his first season in just one summer. And Matt started working with him. And so maybe that can help with some of the biomechanical things in Matt's game that I'm seeing. As the games become more dynamic left to right, east-west offensively, you have to be able to move to keep up. And Matt had a lot of success early playing from a really low wide stance, locked in low and wide. I don't know that you can succeed in today's NHL low and wide. And so that's been part of his adjustment. You saw it this year. I guess the question is, if you're the Penguins, did you see enough as he made that adjustment to believe he can keep making that adjustment and have success with it? Or do you see Jarry, who already plays that way, as having more upside? And of course, contract will come to what's each guy willing to sign for. RFA status, arbitration, I don't even have that in front of me, but all of that stuff matters. They're going to have to answer that question. And frankly, it's interesting because it reminds me of another question. When everybody was ready to throw Marc-Andre Fleury out of Pittsburgh the first time, I said, it depends on whether you think the problems are him or the problems can they be fixed? Because to me, when Flower was struggling, he was all over the place technically. And Mike Bales came in and corrected all that, and we got Flower back to being Flower and a guy that nobody wanted to leave. There are elements of Murray's game that probably needed to be adjusted. The fact he started the adjustment, it's kind of the same question now. Do you think that adjustment's going to be enough? And I would hope the Penguins know that better than anyone. And so they'll be hopefully more informed than anyone else to make that decision. Guessing it from here, my hunch is Jari, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think Jari too. I got one more for you, then we'll let you go, Kevin. We've gone this long and we have not talked about the Vancouver Canucks other than to mention really Jacob Markstrom. You cover that team. You know them better than us. I was covering the game last night. Did they show you something last night that you hadn't seen or didn't know that you were going to be able to see from the Canucks this season? Are they ahead of schedule?
Yeah, they certainly look like it, eh, Dan? Like, there were times in that, like, there's been a learning experience here. And for Jacob Markstrom, too. Like,
yeah.
I know he finished with 926 in the round one, but, like, first goal on him in that series was a goal, like, in terms of just how low quality a shot it was. It was Kevin Fiala, so it's a good shot. But in terms of the type of chance, he hadn't given up a single one of those all season. And all of a sudden, he gives one up in game one, and you're like, ooh, hold on here. Like, is this pressure? Is this rust of 4 months off? I don't have the answer. But again, we talked about game four. Like he wasn't great. And he's the first to tell you that they bailed him out in game four against the Wild. And again, uncharacteristic mistake. So from Markstrom's standpoint, I liked better what I saw last night. Part of that is being busy. And this is the great question with him. Can he be a goaltender that excels when things aren't as busy? He's always been good when he's been busy, and the Canucks, frankly, defensively, have left him busy on a lot of nights. The rest of the team, yeah, man, the intensity that an Elias Pettersson has handled and given back in the first, you know, through the qualifier and into that first game last night, the attention physically that the Blues played on Quinn Hughes and Hughes sort of, I'm good with this, I'm honored by it type mentality. Like, their young players are what drives them. They're older, veteran, bottom six players who you can still fairly argue are overpaid for what they do. But all the things they were supposed to bring that they really didn't from a metric standpoint, at least commensurate to their salary for the past few years, they are bringing in the playoffs. And there seems to be some leadership. I mean, the JT Miller trade, I had questions too about the first round pick. There's no point in pretending I didn't, as a lot of people did. But he's shown, and he didn't have a great playoff pedigree. So they're being led by a guy who had questions about, you know, about his own ability to perform in the postseason. There's a, I guess too, there just seems to be a sense of togetherness. And it's obviously an intangible that you can't measure, but when you're around them during the season, there's a family sort of feel here, a stick up for each other feel that I haven't seen in Vancouver since sort of that 2011 group. And that matters, I think, in the playoffs, right? Like coming to each other's defense, that type of mentality. So, yeah, I'd say they are ahead, and yet they sort of need to be ahead because some of those contracts I just mentioned are going to make things tough. Not long term, but certainly next year. And as you have to start to pay Hughes and Pettersson, who... I mean, Quinn Hughes changed his team. So it's fun to watch. They do appear to be ahead, at least in terms of, I think a lot of people just saw them as making this postseason and maybe not being a team to think about. I think they showed last night that they can be a team that can do some damage. And a lot of that is the ability of their skilled players to sort of manage this tougher hockey. So it's fun. It's exciting times here in Vancouver for sure. It's nice to see the fan base engaged in a positive manner after 5 years of just basically being negative on Twitter.
Well, Kevin, I learn something every week when you write Unmasked. It's one of my favorite things every Friday when it comes out. I've learned about 90 things in this podcast, and I would love to learn 90 more, but we're gonna let you go so you can finish this week's column, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, hey, and I got to say, like, for the record, the column that wouldn't exist without Sean Rourke asking me to write it. So thank you very much for having faith in me to do that and to try and teach people new things. My hope now that is out of those 90 things, at least 40 were correct.
Well, we told you, if you want to learn about goaltending, you listen to Kevin Woodley. I learned a ton. Sean, I know you learned a ton, as you mentioned. We brought up the Penguins goaltending situation with him and the Rangers goaltending situation with him. Let's look at big picture with those two teams right now. The Rangers, the ping pong ball goes their way. They get the number one pick in the draft. Alexi Lafreniere is right for them to pick. And by the way, they need a center, not a left wing, but I think they'll probably pick Lafreniere, right, Sean? I mean, you can't not pick the best player available there, but what a huge part of the Rangers rebuild this is now. When you look back at the team, 7 of the last 11 teams that have won the Stanley Cup did so with a number one pick in the draft.
Yeah, look, it's huge. And they had the number two pick last year in Kako. They got a young goaltender in Shesterkin that, you know, Kevin just raved about. They have some other young pieces. To me, you look at that team, and we're going to talk about the next team who's kind of gone through that and is on the back end of it now. They remind me a little bit of the Rangers. If they can get a little deeper down the middle, but they have those two young building blocks in Lafreniere and Kako. They have an elite goalie in what Marc-Andre Fleury was as Pittsburgh kind of ramped up to becoming a Stanley Cup contender, and now are maybe at the back end of their ability to win a cup. But I think those pieces are in place, and then you have Panarin, so and a young coach to build with in David Quinn. So I think those pieces are there. It's a really exciting time for hockey in general, I think, because look, we live outside of New York. I've lived here for 25 years after growing up outside of Boston. New York's a special place, and when New York is good in anything, it's good for whatever league the team is good in, right? Like, again, 94, the Knicks were good in the NBA. The Rangers won the Cup. It was a special time, not only in New York, but across the NHL, because when your big markets are good, your league's good.
Yeah. And look, 2.5 years ago, the Rangers sent that letter to their season ticket holders saying they were going to rebuild. And you think about what they've gotten so far within this rebuild, it's pretty remarkable. But I do agree with John Davidson and Jeff Gorton. And when they say it's still going to require some patience, they have all these pieces. But other than Zibanejad, Panarin, and Kreider, and maybe I guess you could say now about Buchnevich and Trouba, they're all still so very young, right? I mean, Kako's 19, Lafreniere's 18, Fox is young, Lindgren's young. It's not going to be a quick, like, bang, they're going to be a Stanley Cup contender right away. They should be a playoff team, though. That's the thing. I think that they have reached that point where they got a little taste, a sour taste in their mouth by how they played against Carolina. Maybe learned a few things about how to play playoff style hockey. And I think next season, whenever it comes about, with the talent that they have, they should definitely be pushing for a playoff spot. And I would expect them to have that expectation of, we need to be a playoff team this year.
Of course they need that expectation. They did it this year, but I'll tell you what, and I love Adam Fox. Maybe he should have been in the top three. It was a great year for Calder Trophy candidates. He was a special player who got lost in the Cale Makar and Quinn Hughes spectacular, but their defense is not playoff worthy at this point.
No, I think that they learned a lot in that three games against Carolina of what playoff hockey needs to be, and I wonder if they're going to be better off for it. It was so quick. A team that knows about playoff hockey but hasn't played it well in the last few years, the Pittsburgh Penguins. And now there's the gutting of the coaching staff behind Mike Sullivan. The first changes we're seeing there, Mark Recchi, Jacques Martin, Sergei Gonchar, all out. New voices will be coming in. Jim Rutherford, not hesitant to make changes and also throw guys under the bus when he knows they're not going to be back. He's an unrestricted free agent and didn't like the way he played. But what's your take right now with the Penguins? I mean, they still have Crosby, they still have Malkin, they still have Letang, they have Gensel, but are they a team right now that instills fear into anybody, I guess?
And they have younger guys too. Like, I thought Marino was great. I think he's an elite level defenseman. They certainly have the pieces there to still be good. First of all, I want 30 other Jim Rutherford GMs to do their season ending press conferences. That was gold. I mean, fireworks everywhere, not holding back about anything. But I think they need to retool. They need some fresh blood in, you know, some younger players. But I think that core still has one more run in them. I will never doubt Sidney Crosby, and Rutherford didn't. You know, he was like that, the one player that showed that he cared. You know, I thought the most damning thing that he said was, I don't know that our players wanted to be there after a while. Like, that's all that work that was put in, everything that happened. But then you look on the ice and was that it? I mean, look, they were a better team than the Montreal Canadiens, and they didn't score a goal in the last game. And you could say Carey Price was great. That's not a defense. You know, that's not the 1970s Montreal Canadiens defense. There's no Larry Robinson patrolling that blue line. Like, they have some nice pieces, but Pittsburgh should have handled it, and they didn't. And
I didn't see a push.
Therefore, there are questions, and you're right. Jimmy won't hesitate in dropping a couple of hand grenades in that room to wake them up.
I didn't see a pushback from Pittsburgh. I didn't see that push, that elite push that we have seen so often in that series. If they had it, they'd have won that series, and no, regardless of Carey Price. But I like the fact that they are doing something with the coaching staff. Not to say that Jacques Martin and Gonchar and Recchi aren't good coaches and, you know, and whatnot, but Mike Sullivan needs, you know, some new ideas, some fresh blood, some fresh voices there to push him too. I think that's a very important thing.
Yeah, it reminds me of when Q was on his way out in Chicago, and first Mike Kitchen went, who had been his loyal his loyal assistant for so long, and that was kind of the first wake up call. It was kind of like, okay, you have to do this. You don't want to do it, you have to do it. And now you're kind of on warning. And look, I think Jimmy loves Sullivan, and he's won two cups for him, and he thinks he's one of the best coaches in the world. But if a coach loses his room, it doesn't matter how smart you are.
Hey, Q13 with the Blackhawks, and it didn't save him. So we'll see what happens there. Before we get out of here, we do have to touch on the Toronto Maple Leafs. And Austin Matthews saying it's embarrassing what happened to them, losing again in the, what I guess you constitute the qualifying round, but really the, you know, a playoff round. They still haven't won one. And I thought a telling quote was from Jake Muzzin, that he said, this group needs to dig in more. Lots of skill and talent, but they don't play playoff hockey enough, and they don't have that will to win. That's coming directly from a two-time Stanley Cup champion in Jake Muzzin, who's on that roster and unfortunately wasn't on the ice for the end of that series against Columbus. But to me, it's just more of the same with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I continue to think to myself of they're like the Washington Capitals before the Capitals figured it out. I think Toronto's going to get it if they're given enough rope to get it. And I wonder, you know, are they going to be given enough rope to get it?
Yeah, and I thought Shanahan saying that it was a step back was damning. Again, you know, I just thought that, you know, you can't be taking steps back. Look at the talent on that team. A different guy said that they weren't engaged in game one, and you know, it took them a while to find their feet, and by the end of the series, they were there. And then, you know, they get shut out in game five. So, you know, I don't think when the season's over, you can say, well, I wasn't there at the start of the playoffs, but I got there by the end. Like, there's no time to ramp up. That was one of the challenges of this series. And look, I will say one thing. Toronto has not been lucky in who they've drawn to be out in the first round of the last four playoffs. They've drawn the Washington Capitals on their way up. They've drawn the Boston Bruins twice, who were one of the hardest teams in hockey to knock out. They only play seven-game series. And then they drew a Columbus team that knocked off Tampa Bay last year. So they have not been lucky in trying to get out of the first round.
No, but they haven't been good enough to get out of the first round either. So luck is only part of it. You got to be there. The other teams were there at the start. The Blue Jackets were there at the start of it. You know, Toronto's got to be there at the start of it. But anyway, I loved having Kevin Woodley on, Sean. I thought it was great to learn all about that goaltending. We got more playoff hockey coming our way today, tomorrow, the next day, and we'll just keep at it. We'll be back doing this again next week to dissect it all.
Yeah, I can't wait. I feel like I'm getting a better playoff shape every day. So maybe by the time we do this next week, I'll be ready to go five overtimes on the podcast.
Oh, you could do five overtimes today. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody, and stay safe out there.